Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is Ella Sorkin from Studio Referral Service. But first, let's talk about something that sort of rocked the music world this week, and that's the Robin Thicke Blurred Lines judgment. What happened was, of course, the Marvin Gaye estate sued Robin Thicke and his producer, co-writers, Pharrell Williams and T.I. because the song sounds similar to Marvin Gaye's Got to Give It Up. And the jury deliberated quite a bit, actually, and heard a lot of testimony over a couple of weeks, and finally gave a verdict in favor of the Marvin Gaye estate. And what they did was they awarded the Gaye estate $7.4 million. So basically what they're saying was that this song sounds very much like the Marvin Gaye hit and sounds close enough that we're going to give you part of the money that was made. One of the things that came out was there was more than $16 million. I think $16.6 million were made from this song alone, of which it was pretty much split. $5 million and change went to Pharrell, $5 million and change went to Robin Thicke, and $1.8 million, I think, went to T.I. And the rest went to the record label and publishers. The big deal here is the music industry is up in arms saying that this is going to change the way songwriters write because they're going to be afraid about what they're going to write, and therefore they're going to play it very safe. And the way I look at it is, I don't think that's ever the case. Songwriters write what they're going to write, and we're all influenced by somebody, no matter what. When we create something, we're standing on the shoulders of the people that came before us. So this is always going to happen. There's always going to be something that's deceptively similar to what's come before. The only factor that really changes anything is whether the song makes money or not. If you have a hit, then of course there's going to be people that will come out of the woodwork and say, wow, this is a problem, and we would like some of your profit. If it's not a hit, no one will ever care. Now you can go back and you can look at other instances where this has happened. For instance, the big one was George Harrison's My Sweet Lord versus the Chiffons' He's So Fine, the early 60s hit. And that was so close, it was amazing. I mean, everybody heard it. The Chiffons and their songwriter, which I can't remember who it is right at the moment, they prevailed in court. Harrison had to pay. On the other hand, we just had something else that happened, where the big hit with Sam Smith, Stay With Me. And they turned around and they settled out of court before there was even a lawsuit with Tom Petty for I Won't Back Down. And if you listen to both songs, what you'll hear is there's one particular line in the Sam Smith song that sounds very much like the hook of I Won't Back Down. Now, of course, they could have taken this to court, and who knows how the jury would have decided. So the easy thing is to just settle out of court, which is what happens on the majority of these things. But to think that this ruling, the Blurred Lines verdict, is going to change songwriters, I think is a little ridiculous, because songwriters are going to write and they're going to keep on doing what they do. And the only time something like this is going to happen is if something makes money. Now, there is an example where you find that songwriters intentionally write like something, and that's mostly in the jingle business, songs for commercials, and also in television and film to some degree, where what you'll have is temp music, and temp music will usually be a hit that everybody knows about. Unfortunately, they can't clear it because it costs too much, so they go to a songwriter and they say, make something that sounds as close to this as you can without it actually being this. So this happens in commercials, and it happens in television, it happens in film, where someone will actually write as close as they can to that song without going over the line, and of course they go right up to the bleeding edge of what might happen. But this is going to keep on going, and songwriters are going to keep on writing, and not much is going to change through this verdict, and I think that's a good thing for music. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Don't forget about my new coaching program. It's 101 mixing tricks Big Studio Tricks for the Small Studio. You can go to 101mixingtricks.com to learn more. Now, another thing that happened this week that was sort of a big deal that was overlooked is Apple introduced a new MacBook Pro that's really amazing. It's really small, it's really thin, and it's very, very sexy. But one of the things that makes it so thin is the fact that it has a brand new port on it called a USB-C port. So in other words, up until now, we've had USB, USB 2, USB 3, and this is now USB-C. It's a very, very small connector, and it's bidirectional, so it doesn't matter how you plug it in, where all the other USB connectors, you had to plug it in one way to make it work. And this particular connector can be plugged in either way, like Apple's Lightning cables. USB-C is actually USB 3.1. It's the next iteration of USB 3. And what they're calling it is USB Type-C, and it's abbreviated to USB-C. But it has a lot of things going for it. Of course, it's a smaller connector, and that's cool. And what that means is you're going to see it on a lot of mobile devices. Not only will you see it just on computers, both desktops and laptops, you're going to see it on phones. You're going to see it on just about everything. And there's a good reason for it. First of all, it has a boatload of bandwidth. It's much better than just about anything out there except Thunderbolt. It has 10 gigabits per second bandwidth, which is twice as much as USB 3.0. It's about half of what the latest iteration of Thunderbolt is. But the fact of the matter is, for audio, that's plenty of bandwidth. There's not a problem at all with 10 gigabits per second. So it has that going for it. The other thing it has is it can supply up to 100 watts of power, which is an enormous amount. And what this basically means is you can have one of the brand new high-resolution 4K monitors. And just with this one cable, it has enough bandwidth to be able to support that. Plus, it will be able to supply enough power to support it as well. So that's very, very cool. It also means it will charge your devices a lot faster, and everybody always likes that. USB-C is also backwards compatible, and one of the things that might come out of this is that you might see some of these other ports go away. For instance, why have a Lightning port or a Thunderbolt port and, of course, a USB 3 port when you have this brand new smaller port that's bidirectional and that can support all the things that these ports that we've been using for a while, only better. So look for this USB-C connector because you're going to see it more and more. The downside right now is that you need an adapter to connect all of your other peripherals that already have USB. This is backwards compatible, so it will work with the USB 1.0, 2.0, 3.0, but you'll need an adapter because it's a different size connector. And the adapters are expensive. They only come from Apple right now. But as soon as we see the third-party companies get involved selling their own peripherals and adapters and cables, you're going to see that come down. And this is going to be a very, very cool thing in the audio business, in the video business, and just in computers in general. My guest today is Ellis Sorkin from Studio Referral Service. Ellis was working as an engineer at the famed A&M studio complex in Hollywood when he got the idea for a service that would help artists and labels and producers and engineers book just the right studio for their needs. Since then, Ellis's Studio Referral Service has worked with some of the biggest artists in the world and some of the biggest studios in the world. I spoke with Ellis via Skype from his office just outside of Los Angeles. So, Ellis, thanks so much for being with me today. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Let's start with Studio Referral Services. How would you explain that to somebody? If someone that owns a studio came up to you and says, well, how does SRS benefit me? What would you say?
Well, if it was a studio owner, I would say that it would be a no-brainer because it's like a way to increase business with virtually no cost to them and awareness of their brand. Essentially, we've made a lot of studios happen from places that were just getting going that became huge sort of because of us. I mean, one example I can think of is a place called NRG.
Oh, yeah.
Essentially, when he got in business, his mother had actually called me. This is back in like early 80s, I want to say. And she had told me she wanted to buy him a 24 track. And I said, okay. And I said, you want to start a studio? And she goes, yeah, he wants to be in the studio business. And essentially told them how to get about that. And they ended up renting what is currently LAFX's studios. Back then, it was Alpha originally.
I remember.
And, you know, it had fame because Prince had done 1999 there, apparently. And what happened was, I guess they moved into the bigger place that they ended up on. Actually, no, they moved into Warner Brothers, I think, at that point. The Amigo Studios.
Right.
And he took over that house and started doing sessions out of there. I can't remember the first console he had. I want to say it might have been an old Neve or an API over there. I don't recall. But we brought him his first real client, which was Thomas Dolby. Mm. And Thomas, you know, ended up staying there for a long time and doing lots of projects and built that studio pretty much. And then eventually he got a little bigger and he took over what was Weddington Studios. And I brought him his first clients over there, a guy named John Silva.
Oh, yeah.
You know, John, back then, this is way before Nirvana. This is when he was managing like Red Cross, House of Freaks, a bunch of other rock bands like that. And we did all those projects there. And eventually I turned him on to, was it Linkin Park or Limp Bizkit? I meant to hear which one it was, but whichever one it was that was stayed there for 10 years.
Wow.
Doing all their projects. And I don't know, I have a mental block with those two, but it was one of the two. I think it was Linkin Park is what I mean. Yeah, it was Linkin Park, not Limp Bizkit. And what ended up happening was that place sort of became a real landmark in the studio world at this point. It's one of the better known rock studios there are.
Now, when you get producer or artist clients, they don't pay anything, right?
No, absolutely not. As a matter of fact, I've been offered by people, well, let me pay you. And I said, no, it's taken care of. Don't worry about it.
So it's a studio that pays then?
Yes, the studios all support us. And at this point, there's nearly 700 of them internationally.
Wow. Wow. So you started in Los Angeles then, right? And you moved out from there. How did that happen? Well, let's talk about how you get into this, because this is a really highly specialized and unusual niche.
Sure. What happened was obviously, I was an engineer. I was a staff engineer with A&M all through the 70s, early 70s, and until 1980. And met a lot of people, worked on a lot of incredible projects, and knew a lot of producers and engineers and whatnot. In late 79, I want to say, I was hanging out in the front office talking to some of the girls, and the lady that was the tape librarian there had been reading Billboard. And she said, well, this is an interesting article. And I said, what? And she says, well, this guy that's the road manager of Genesis is buying studio time that's unbooked in London and then reselling it to the local bands at a discount. And I said, oh, that's an interesting kind of concept. And it just sort of struck a chord. And then not that long after that, I thought, you know, there's so many studios in LA. There's just like at that time, I think there were around 80 or so. And it was like, wouldn't it be cool if there was a place that people could just call and find what was appropriate for what they needed to do technically, budget-wise, location, all that kind of good stuff with just a phone call and perhaps get a good deal on it as well. And so when it was first started, it was actually called Studio Discount and Referral Service because I thought maybe we'd be dealing that. Then I realized shortly, yeah, it's not a good name and dropped the discount. And we went out initially when I started it, I just went to every studio owner and I said, listen, this is what I want to do. And pretty much everybody welcomed it with welcome arms because they thought, well, this is cool. I've got not much to lose and a lot to gain. And that's how it got going.
Boy, so you've been doing it since 1980.
Correct.
Meaning that you've seen the business change in small and large ways.
Absolutely.
And of course it has. And for a lot of the people listening to this, they don't realize because they haven't been around that long, but it was a totally different business back in 1980. Well, the 80s and 90s, really, it was a Absolutely. Totally different business.
Absolutely.
So how were there pivot points that you saw things really change? Was there some point in time where it's like, oh, this business is going to be different?
Oh, yes, absolutely. There were several. Early on, obviously, things were just gangbusters because everybody had to have a studio. There was no place to record. Nobody had home studios or anything like that. You know, there was no such thing as small format recordings and obviously nothing digital at all. And so everybody that was making a record needed a place, and we were swamped constantly. I mean, there were many times that we just couldn't even find a studio for somebody that, you know, had a particular need. We need an SSL console. And it was like, okay, well, I've got 35 of them and none of them are available, you know, for a particular date or something like that. And so, and the volume of business was almost overwhelming. We would have sometimes 30, 40 sessions a day coming in.
Wow.
And so that sort of slowed down. Well, actually, it probably peaked when 48-track analog was the thing. The bigger SSLs were always in demand, have to have, you know, 80 inputs, 100 inputs, whatever, and all these Linksys, and it was just a crazy time. And I remember putting together sessions that lasted months and things like that, which all of that is now obviously very different. The lengths of sessions is dramatically reduced, and obviously budgets are way reduced in all but a few circumstances. When that started going down as far as like the transitioning, I want to say that was sometime in the mid 90s maybe that it started to decline. And different points along the way, things changed a little bit as the home studio circuit started to come along. Obviously, in the advent of half-inch 8-track was the first kind of step into that puddle. And then obviously once ADATs came along, it got a little bit bigger, and all the other low-end formats, 1-inch 16, half-inch 16, these things all sort of progressed until we finally got into Pro Tools, obviously Sound Tools originally. And in the very beginning of that whole digital era, very few people had any idea how to use Pro Tools. I remember a period of time, I think we might have discussed a gentleman named Sam Ward, who was the first person that really seemed to totally get Pro Tools. And so anybody that had to use it almost had to go to him. And obviously now it's like everybody and their brother has it, knows it, whatever. Although I'm not 100% sure how well. I look back to the time when he was the master of it all, and I just wonder how, and it took him so long to get there, I just wonder how everybody can be so accomplished these days even, you know.
He grew up in it, so I guess.
I guess so, yeah. If it's all they even conceive of or know, I guess it's a different market. Unfortunately, not one I'm involved with anymore, since I'm not really engineering anymore, nor have I for quite some time.
Well, so when, let's say the 1-inch 8-track came around, I know it must have impacted your business.
Right.
But when did it occur to people with home studios that maybe they needed your services? Because I'm just assuming, but I think it's all commercial studios up until then that were your clients, right?
Yes, we pretty much only had commercial studios. Home studios started coming along and hitting me up to see if I could bring them business. It's probably been in the mid-90s also, I want to say. Maybe even, yeah, probably around then. Maybe even early 90s, I guess. The half-inch 8-track situation was really just a very early step in that manner. I don't think we had very many home studios even at that point that we would send business to. It was just, I knew sonically it wasn't the same thing. And I have always had an issue with trying to make sure that our clients are getting the best possible product. And I sometimes would sway them if I could from some of those lesser formats.
Now, there was a point, I don't remember if it must have been the late 80s, early 90s, where a lot of people would put very substantial multi-track studios in their houses. And we're talking in the analog days where they have an SSL in their house. And that made big ripples in LA, where all the commercial studios were getting together and say, wait a second, they're hurting our business. How did that affect you? Because I'm sure some of those people came to you and said, can you help us get some business?
Well, it didn't really change too much. I mean, I do remember exactly how it all started, the whole war between home studios and commercial studios. It was a studio up in Woodland Hills that Chaz Sanford had.
That's right, yeah.
And essentially, I can't remember the name of it at the moment, but...
Secret Sound, wasn't it?
Yes, you're right, Secret Sound. Yes, he had been working on a session at Conway, from what I understand, and had left flyers for his studio, I guess in their lounge or in the control room or something like that. And Buddy, the owner, got wind of that and totally freaked. And obviously that phenomenon had already started where some people had home studios. I think Hank Santacola had one as well, which was a very high-end one as well. And shortly thereafter, HARP was formed, which was this organization created by the owners of studios, commercial studios, to try and fend off or to try to create a more equal balance between the commercial and residential studios so that they had to pay the same kind of taxes and had to deal with the same kind of legislation of where and what they could do. That's sort of where that whole riff started. It sort of grew to a peak. I remember there were meetings that they all had, the owners of the commercial places. And I think what happened was at one point, O'Henry, which was Hank Santacola's place, he actually was raided by the police or whoever it was that came in, and they were taking photographs and they were tried to close him down, basically. And he had a major studio in his house in Toluca Lake. It was, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it was sort of like on the level of an Ocean Way or something like that, or United as it's called now, in a home with a giant API console in a room that was probably 40 feet deep and 25 feet wide. And they'd done a lot of major projects there. And
Wasn't it Leon Russell's old studio?
It was originally Leon Russell's, yes.
Yeah.
It was right next to Bob Hope's house.
Yeah.
And eventually he got tired, I think, of the whole back and forth with this whole scene and essentially opened up the commercial place that he had for many years, the O'Henry on Magnolia there in Burbank.
Yeah.
And that was sort of like a slap in the face to the other commercial places. It's like, hey, don't screw with me. I play harder, you know? And
yeah.
He obviously did. And Chaz, I guess, disappeared into Nashville or whatever he did, you know, next.
Right, right. But did you get those guys work?
Yes, I got Hank a fair amount of work in his home situation. I think we did Poison there and Rat and a couple other projects over the years. I didn't do much of anything with Chaz that I recall, maybe a session here or there. Trying to think. There was another. Oh, Richard Landis also had a pretty serious one, the Gray Room.
Yeah, yeah.
Up in his place. And we did some stuff with him as well. I remember some projects with Bev Jones and David Sigerson that we had done there until I think Richard sort of did something one day that sort of turned them off and, you know, involved me and just sort of ended all that.
Well, wasn't there any political ramifications from the commercial studios that you were working with?
About me working with these people?
Yeah.
You know, it didn't happen all that often that it ever came up, really. I think there were occasions where there may have been like, hey, are you doing that? And, you know, it would be so minor that it just sort of went away. Mm. And at that time, also keep in mind, there was so much business going on that it just really was neither here nor there. I mean, there was just countless sessions going on. It's a whole different world than we saw starting in the early 2000s, late 90s, whatever.
Yeah, that's something that people that weren't around back then can't understand. The volume of work that was available and the budgets that were available, it was such a completely different world than it is today.
Mind-boggling compared to today, yeah. I think the average budget probably then was probably 150 or 200,000 was an average budget. Maybe.
Yeah, yeah, right, right. As a, on the low end, sure.
Yeah.
Let's go back to your days at A&M.
Sure.
When I first got into town in 1980, I worked at A&M, not on staff, but I worked on projects there for two or three years. So I remember it when it was in its original stage.
Right.
And I thought it was one of the best studios ever. It was a magnificent place.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah, it was an incredible place to have basically grown up because I started there when I was, you know, 18, 19 years old. And lived there pretty much all those years.
Yeah. I remember the coffee. I still tell people the coffee was like rocket fuel. It was like nothing I have ever tasted anywhere. It wasn't particularly good, but boy, it would keep you going.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Who knows what was in it?
Yeah. All right. So what kind of sessions did you work on there?
Oh, pretty much everybody and anybody you could imagine. I was in the assistant world. Obviously, you started as a trainee is what we had. We had a trainee program back then, one of the most amazing anywhere. There were very few of those things anyway. I think maybe RCA had one and Capitol had one, but not on the level of the A&M one. We churned people in and out like a machine. We tried to create a crew that was like untouchable. And I remember one year we went through something like 30 or 40 guys just in and out the door because they weren't right for this reason, that reason, you know, said the wrong thing to somebody, looked at somebody the wrong way, who knows, you know? And early on, I'm trying to remember the earliest sessions. I mean, I'll get into that later, but we used to, the seconds became attached to some senior engineer at some point or another. And I was lucky enough to have been assistant to Dick Bogert, to Henry Louis, to Hank Sicalo, and Larry Levine at varying times. And during those years, it would be whatever they were working on. I mean, with Hank Sicalo, it was always with Lou Adler. So I worked some things on the Rocky Horror Picture Show, some things with Carole King, Cheech and Chong, David T. Walker, Mary, who sang on the Stones,
Mary Clayton.
Mary Clayton, yes, exactly. One of her records. I just drew a blank on her last name. And with Henry Louis, I worked on Joni Mitchell predominantly.
Yeah.
Worked on Court and Spark, Miles of Isles.
Wow.
Of course, mainly Hissing of Summer Lawns. That was an entire album start to finish with her. With Larry Levine, I worked with Phil Spector a little bit on various projects, a little bit with Donovan, Dion. Another gentleman, Ray Gerhart, who I didn't mention, I worked with the Carpenters here and there a little bit. Dick Bogert, I worked with, his main client was a guy named Rick Gerard, who was famous for doing Jefferson Airplane's Surrealistic Pillow and Nielsen's records and whatnot. And so I worked with them on a variety of projects, Feliciano and Johnny Mathis, although that wasn't with Rick Gerard. Neil Diamond, not with one of them, with somebody independent, I believe. I can't remember who did that. Joan Baez, I did a lot of stuff with Kirschenbaum. Worked a lot with Richard Perry, Carly Simon, and a few other projects. It just sort of goes on and on. George Harrison also, of course, he had his studio, I mean, his label with us, so I worked with George a bit.
Yeah. How long were the projects as compared to today?
Mostly a lot longer. The only exception that I knew was the Joan Baez Diamonds and Rust record that I worked on, which was phenomenally quick. I think we tracked everything live, including the vocals, and it was done, our end of it, in 2 weeks.
Whoa.
They then went to Cecil and Margoloff and did synths, and then we mixed it. And it was like maybe 3-4 weeks for the entire album. But most projects, I mean, Joni's records went on for 6 months. A lot of these other records, the Carpenters, whatnot, were also pretty long. I didn't work on some of these people on their entire project. Sometimes it would be just, you know, a week here, a few days there, in and out. Neil Diamond, too, was like, you know, 3 days, 4 days, and then out. So as far as full lengths, I would say that they were on average maybe 2-3 months at least. Because there were some that were 6 months and more, and there were some that were done in 2 months. 2 months was a short album, I guess, in those days, you know.
Well, of course, we spend that kind of time today, but it's not all in one chunk, it seems.
Right, and it's also not usually in a real studio.
Yeah,
the entire time. It's probably maybe a quarter in a real studio at the most, and the rest in somebody's home or something.
And also the hours were a lot different back then. And today it seems like we're more of a, I don't want to say 9-to-5, but, you know, more of a day gig, rather than back then where it could go all day and all night, or start it, you know, late at night. Very different.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, I remember the Joni records were, she would book it from 7 on, and sometimes she'd show up at 10 or 11.
Yeah.
And we would just hang out waiting until she would show up, you know.
There's lots of stories about that.
Oh yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Not only from her, but from everybody basically. I didn't work too much in the 70s, but everybody I know that was working back then, you know, basically says the same thing, where you're booked for one time and it could happen 12 hours later.
Right. Yeah, definitely. I think it happened even more so that way in rock, which we didn't do a heck of a lot of rock over there. I mean, we really were more the pop place. I mean, Supertramp did a record, which I did next to nothing on, that was mainly Eddie Thacker that was involved in that stuff, and Kent Scott, of course. Mm-hmm. I mean, George wasn't really rock at the time, but it was mainly one record that he did there, was the Crackerbox Palace. I mean, what was it called? 33 and a Third.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he did some things with sitar, Ravi Shankar.
Oh, yeah.
He did a project there with Ravi, which I was involved a little bit with, which was a lot of fun.
You know, I met Ravi once, and he was the most amazing man. It was at a party, and it was like he was the center of attention, and there was this light that shone from him. It was just, yeah. He was an amazing guy that you didn't realize until you were actually in a room with him.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, I picked up on that a little bit, too. I mean, I didn't have much one-on-one with him. It was pretty much just, you know, working as the assistant on that stuff. But, I mean, George had that same light, totally. And George I worked with quite a bit, so it was really an amazing, amazing person. You know, a lot of these people were. I mean, Joni was amazing. Baez was amazing. You know, just interesting people.
What I remember about A&M that I really liked that you never see anymore, I don't know if it was really good acoustically to begin with, but it was kind of cool, was the fact that the consoles were up high so you can stand behind them. And you'd sit on bar stools, basically, that were high enough to be able to work on. And I thought that was great. It was very comfortable all the time. And you never got, you know, back problems from sitting all the time.
Yeah, and you're probably more alert, too.
Yeah, yeah. That was a great idea.
Yeah.
And it was the only place I've ever seen that, actually.
I think Howard Holzer may have been behind that. He was the guy who originally helped design. He built the studios, consoles, the Hayco consoles, which were the original boards there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think any of them were there by the time you got in there in the 80s.
No, they're Tridents.
Oh, really? Okay.
We had TSMs.
All Hayco consoles, and then moved into APIs eventually. And I think there was one Trident TSM at some point and a Quad 8 Coronado at one point.
Yeah, that was in the back room. That was in D.
Super D. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So you go into Studio Referral Services, and was it an immediate hit?
Pretty quick, actually. The first, I think it got going in July of 80. Oh, was it July? Yeah, July of 80. And it just, I marketed it a bit. I had some articles in what was at the time Cashbox, if you remember Cashbox,
sure.
And something in Billboard. And it just sort of gained momentum pretty quickly. I mean, once it got on online and got, not online like in the internet, since we didn't even have email or anything, which made it a lot more challenging. In the years, the first few years, it would grow dramatically, like 100% plus each year, the volume.
Wow.
And obviously that tapered off after about 10 years or 12 years or whatever it was, but it definitely hit a certain type of magnitude that was pretty crazy at points.
So how have your clients changed then over the years?
Well, a lot in the early days, it would be the producer themselves calling, or the engineer, or sometimes even the artist. Nowadays, it's usually more, and has been for quite some time, usually the management company of those producers or engineers. That was a big period probably in the maybe mid-late 90s when managers started coming around. There weren't managers back in that day. It was just the people doing it themselves. I remember when the first management companies started around, like Steve Moyer was one of the first management companies that we used to do business with. And one other guy, Sandy Robertson, had one of those earlier ones too. And this is before Moyer Marie or before McDonough or before, you know, Bennett all had their independent businesses. And that was largely where a lot of the business came from back then. These days, it's labels, it's management companies still. A lot of times, just the A&R people, it gets passed on about studio referral service. And they just, even if somebody is leaving, they say, hey, when you start doing these things, you need to know about this guy.
That's great.
And so it's even been generations of people. A lot of label heads know about us and pass that on to their A&R people as well. I know over the years we've done a lot of stuff, you know, for Jimmy Iovine and stuff via his people. You know, it's like his staff would all be aware and it would get passed forward. And so that's where it comes from these days largely is mainly labels, directly management companies. We do a lot of alternative things too. We do a lot of filming for whatever, commercials, movies, TV shows that need studios. They come to us like location scouts and whatnot. And we also do other things. We do a lot of leasing and selling the facilities these days too.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Well, are there that many on the market?
Not always, but I mean, there was a demand. I mean, and it just started coming to me. I never marketed this or anything like that. But I mean, we sold Soundcastle, we sold Cherokee, we sold Encore, we sold Front Page, Third Stone, what used to be called Sound Chamber, which is Rafael Sadiq's place now. Blakesley. There's about a dozen or so that we've sold over the years, some smaller ones. And then the leasing thing is, again, a new thing that's come up in the last 10 years or so that's people that have maybe a home studio that just it's not working for them anymore. Maybe they have a lot of high-end clients and it's just not comfortable bringing these people into their homes with the dog and the wife and the kids, and it's just not professional. And so we have a lot of that going on. On all different levels, from people just leasing small production rooms to whole facilities with gear and the whole shot.
You probably have a better understanding and overview of the studio business than anybody else, because you're looking at it from a level that I think few people get to look at. And that leads me to think that you probably have a better understanding of where the business is going as well as where it's come from. But Where do you think it's going? How do you see everything evolving?
Well, currently it seems for quite a few years now, probably at least 5 years, I would say, things seem to have come into their own kind of flow that is pretty much the same as it has been. Nothing's changed a lot. There still seems to be a fair amount of major clients that will use studios for however long. You know, there's the Lady Gagas, the Maroon 5s, the people that have significant budgets that like the experience of being in a real studio. And then, of course, most of the urban artists really dig being in a real pro kind of place. And they like the vibe and the energy of, you know, having people around working for them and doing this and that. And that kind of scene, you know, keeps going, and I think is keeping a lot of the studios alive. I think a lot of the owners have just adjusted to this new reality and just keep it going. You know, I mean, like the investments aren't what they used to be. They don't have to spend as much anymore. I mean, the days of buying $1 million consoles are gone. And I think things are just sort of status quo. It seems like it's just continuing.
It feels to me like there's actually more studios coming online than there has been in quite a while. Am I wrong in that?
I wouldn't say you're wrong, but I would say there's not a lot of new significant places coming along. There may be a lot of people getting into the business on a mid-level kind of area, but I don't see a lot of new Conways or Villages or places like that opening up. No, I mean, like, I can only think of really a couple that have opened up in the last five to 10 years even that are major kind of places.
Yeah, I know that you're in Los Angeles and you started in Los Angeles. How did it work that you transitioned to being more national and international even? How did that work out?
Well, the national stuff was sort of always there. I mean, even back in the earlier days, it's funny because the whole cost of doing business has changed so much too. It's like I remember back in the early days, it used to cost like $1.50 a minute to call New York.
Yeah.
You know? And of course, we did it because it made sense still. But it was like, you know, the business just sort of came. The national stuff just came along and we did it. even since probably the mid-80s and stuff. We were booking stuff in New York and Nashville and whatnot, although not so much in a lot of other places in the country like we do now. I mean, the demand for places in Chicago and Atlanta and Miami and all that kind of stuff, I think that sort of came along more in the 90s kind of. The international stuff really sort of came into its own probably in the late 90s, early 2000s, as far as the volume of business we were getting for it, as the internet became more essential and necessary to doing business, and communication there was getting easier and better. The pivotal album that we did that really exposed me to more international studios than any was the Lady Gaga Born This Way record. They were in 23 different studios around the world.
Whoa.
And we put all of it together, and it was a great experience because I picked up places that I had no idea about until I did a lot of research online and found this and that because they had specific needs that they had, and was able to put it all together for that. That was probably the biggest album we've ever done, actually, too, now that I think about it, as far as it was like over a year of time that they were touring and whatnot and doing all the different setups that we did everywhere. And it was quite cool because the budgets were pretty much whatever it took. And generally, every studio had to sign NDAs, and every place they booked the entire facility instead of just a room because they either had the need for that or just didn't want anybody else in the building. So quite a good time on that one.
Boy, that doesn't happen often, does it?
Not anymore, no.
Do people come to you for mastering help as well?
Yes, to a degree, but not often. It's just a side thing that we do. The same thing with rehearsal. We don't really like to get involved with rehearsals, but if it's somebody that's a client of ours normally and they need something, we'll try to hook it up. I don't really want to bother with somebody that says, hey, I need to go in Thursday for 3 hours to, you know, for $8 an hour to rehearse my drums. We don't do that.
Yeah.
So touring band, and we know they're going to be in there for a couple of weeks or something like that, and they need to be able to fly in the studio and lighting rigs and all that kind of stuff, then sure. Absolutely.
Last question.
Sure.
What's the best piece of advice, music business advice, that you either learned along the way or someone imparted to you?
Good question. I think from the engineering standpoint, if we look back at that world, it would be humble, be seen and not necessarily heard unless you're needed to be, and be efficient and perfect in what you do, because there's no room for screw-ups. Is what I learned on that end of it. In the general studio business world, I think it's just service, service, service. Be available, be flexible, and be really good at what you do.
And
the best at what you do.
And you certainly are. So that's
thank you.
That's
thank
very
you.
Cool. Ellis, thanks so much for being with me today. This is great.
My pleasure.
To find out more about Ellis and Studio Referral Services, go to studioreferral.com. That's Studio Referral, no S, it's one word, studioreferral.com. Thanks for listening and being my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Thanks a lot to Steve Cherubino, who's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com. He helps put this podcast together. I really appreciate it. Thank you, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes or Stitcher. At bobbyosinski.com and also at bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I'll see you next time.